1, 2, 3, 4.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth episode of the Behind the Curtain Ministry podcast. Today is a special episode. First time that we're not doing our interview over the phone. I'm sitting here at the table with David Singleton. David is the youth pastor at Crossroads Church, which is the church that I'm a pastor at and planted about 9 years ago. And David and I'm looking forward to chatting with David, doing it live, and I think you're really going to enjoy this talk. Before we jump right into things, just want to remind you to subscribe to the podcast. We will post kind of randomly every 2 or 3 weeks or so a new episode, so be sure to subscribe on iTunes, and those episodes will just pop up in your window. And also check out at acrossroads.net, and you will find a bunch of articles related to these topics, but also a specific bonus material for today's interview. So with that, I'll introduce David. David has been at our church at Crossroads. We're in Lansing, Michigan for a year. Before that, and he can tell you a little bit more about this throughout the interview, but he was in Philadelphia and Compton, New Jersey for about 2 years.
Camden. Yeah, Camden.
Thank you, David.
No problem.
And we are live. I can't cut that out. Man, I wrote that very wrong in my notes. I've been to Camden. I should know that. Camden, New Jersey. And then also 2 years in the Watts and Compton areas of Los Angeles. For the sake of our topics today, I will say David is black, since you can't see him. The reason I mention that is last episode I interviewed a white pastor named Pastor Chris Lockamy, and he's from Baltimore. And Chris and I, both being white, sort of had similar backgrounds growing up in the suburbs, white churches, those sorts of things. Interviewed Chris about the Baltimore riots that had just taken place, he being a pastor in Baltimore. And one thing that came up from that conversation with Chris was I realized that there was these two narratives going on, between the white narrative and a black narrative. And I thought, so David, I'll start there, but first I should just say welcome and
thank you.
Thanks for hanging out and being on the podcast with us.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, man. So talk to me a little bit, and first of all, I'll preface this. I'm not trying to talk bad about white people here at all, nor was Chris in the last episode. There's simply a matter of you don't know what you don't know. And one of the reasons I like to talk about these things, though, is there is also an issue, though, of I don't want to know.
Yeah.
And so that's why I want to talk about these things. Mm-hmm. And so for white folks like myself, I'd encourage you to just want to know and to listen and just be humble and learn. That's really what spiritual growth and maturity is just listening and learning. So So David, I think the white narrative when a Baltimore riot hits the news or a Ferguson shooting or Eric Garner's death is that these are isolated incidents, right? These are one-time things. Even the way they're covered on the news, it feels like a one-time incident. Tell us a bit about the narrative going on in the black community that have led to these things. And I would guess you would say these are not one-time incidents.
No, these aren't one-time incidents at all. So when I grew up, my dad, he would teach us basically how to survive getting pulled over by the police.
Right.
Keep your hands on the steering wheel all the time. Always use the sirs and the ma'ams and stuff like that. If they tell you get out the car, just get out the car. Try to be as compliant as possible. Your whole goal is to get out there alive. And like, I'll talk to police officers in the past, like, and they talk about how, like, if you ran, you guaranteed to get beat. I talked to my friends who've gotten beat by police. All types of stuff like that. So it's not a one-time incident. It's actually, like, it's been ongoing for not years. It's been ongoing for decades and decades and decades. So what you have is you have this thing that's been happening to people that's been going on for decades, and this anger is building up. And in the past generation, the last generation, they kind of just took it. Because that's just kind of how they grew up. They grew up with it. They kind of just took it. And so even if you have my generation, and my generation is a lot less apt to take it. I'm like 25 or whatever. But then you have this younger generation who's like 7, 8 years younger than me. And they're not going to take it at all. Mm-hmm. They're not going to. They don't like it. They're tired of it. And every time they get pulled over, they get a little bit angry and a little bit madder. Matter of fact, every time I get pulled over, I get a little bit angry and a little bit madder. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying they should respond with violence or to I don't know. They shouldn't respond like that. They shouldn't. But I understand it. Mm-hmm. I'm 25 years old. I'm about as far away, especially now, from crime as you can think. And I've been pulled over well over a dozen times, and most times for no reason at all. Mm-hmm. They won't even give me a reason. They just pull me over and then mm-hmm. go through my car. So, like, it makes me mad, and I can see why they're mad too. So, yeah.
And when you say take it, can you elaborate on that even beyond being pulled over for being black, so to speak, which we will talk a little bit more about, but what else is going on, let's say, on a maybe a systemic level when it comes to taking it?
So, explain your question.
I can clarify that, too. I'll transition a little bit. One thing that Chris and I talked about last week was the "we can't breathe" mm-hmm. Phrase that came out, sort of became popular after Eric Garner's death. And the idea of "we can't breathe," obviously, is he's suffocated to death. Uh-huh. But we as a people, we as black people, have been trying to speak and trying to say things,
yeah.
and it just hasn't been heard. It's like we're saying things and nobody's listening.
Uh-huh.
We can't breathe. Like, yeah. it's like we're being suffocated by, you know, I would say suffocated by white culture, suffocated by, like,
yeah.
suffocated. So talk about that a little bit.
So if you talk about, like, systemic, like, racial issues,
sure.
for the most part.
Yeah.
Well, it depends. Like, I have a limited perspective on, all the racial disparity between blacks and whites. All I can speak is from my own perspective, so I'm not speaking for blacks
sure.
as a whole.
Right,
Just want to, like, clarify that real quick. But, like, from the people that I've been in contact with, from Philadelphia to Camden to Los Angeles to my hometowns in Florida and stuff like that, the whole idea is we were marginalized. We've been marginalized. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We've been marginalized for, like, a really long time. It's been forever. And nobody hears us. We say that we're treated differently than everybody else. People say that we're being sensitive. We say that, like, the police mess with us and mm-hmm. beat us, and or that the police they target us, like, unduly, right? Or mm-hmm. they search us illegally and stuff like that. Nobody believes us. We'll say that we can't get jobs that everybody else could get, even if we have the same qualifications. Nobody believes us. And then it's like, basically what people call it is like oppression or whatever, oppression, or like the old folks used to say, it was the man putting his foot on us
mm-hmm,
or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so they're tired of it. They're like, they're just tired of it. They're tired mm-hmm. of it altogether. Tired mm-hmm. of it. Yeah, they're tired of everything on top of everything. And it, yeah, I mean, like, I'm from the South, right? I'm from the South, so it's a little different. I'm from, like, Northern Florida. If you don't know about Northern Florida, you might think, oh, Florida,
right,
it's a beach. It's like, I don't know, a Daytona or something. No, that's not Northern Florida. Northern Florida is like Florida, Georgia, right? That's what some people call it. And there is some, it's a lot better than it was when my dad was growing up. It's a lot better than it was when my granddad was growing up. But I still have people that look at me like I'm straight there. I've had people that I say hi to, and they look it back at me like, why are you speaking to me? You know you shouldn't speak to me. Mm-hmm. I remember I used to live in Alabama, too, when I was younger. I would walk past people, and they'd call me the N-words and stuff like that. And all that stuff, it plays over and over and over again in your head. And like I said before, you just get tired of it. After a long period of time, you get tired of it. But here's the thing. I'm not excusing the actions in Baltimore. I'm not excusing the actions in Ferguson. I'm not advocating violence towards people because you get angry about something. That's not right. But here's another key issue there. The people who are acting out against, like, those oppressions that they see, it's not the most educated people.
Mm-hmm.
They're really not. Like, have you ever been to, like, an inner city school? I used to work inside an inner city school. I used to do this gang intervention, like, mentor program. I was shocked. It was in Markham. It was Markham Middle School in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked. They treat them like prisoners. Hmm. The classrooms are so loud. Oh, I'm sorry. The classrooms are so loud that the kids who are trying to listen have a hard time hearing. A lot of the kids can barely read. A lot of the kids don't have parents to force them to do homework and go to school. A lot of the teachers giving up on the kids. Not all teachers, there's great teachers in Markham Middle School. Respect to Mr. Parker and all the great things that he's doing there. But it's hard. It's really hard. And that's just not one school. It's all of the inner city schools. Maybe not all of them, but a high majority of them. So you get people who they don't have the ability to articulate what's going on in their communities and in their culture and all the oppression that they feel. So they act out in profane ways, kind of.
I want to come back to that inner city school topic in a second. First, I want to ask you, you talked about when you say things about being pulled over or how police treat you and whatever, and white people don't believe you. How does it feel as a Christian when white Christians don't believe you?
Well, like, as a Christian or period, I don't expect white people to believe me. Like, I don't. And this is kind of awkward to even talk about, especially because people won't hear this. Anyways, so most times I don't.
Right, we're going behind the curtain here.
Yeah.
You're on the hot seat.
But most.
No, you're good.
But most times I won't talk to white people about racial issues.
Right, right.
Like, hardly ever.
Right.
And so like, maybe white people who know me, they'll think, oh, racial issues aren't a problem with David.
Right.
Right. But they are a problem, right? And if I'm talking to black people, they come up a lot more than the white people or whatever, except for like Noah and Kurt and them, which are the pastors at Crossroads or whatever. So I normally don't talk about racial issues because I assume they won't believe me.
Sure.
Because I've been not believed so many times in the past, or people trying to argue me like, oh, that didn't really happen. And it's frustrating. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like if I got molested, right? And then I come and I tell like an authority figure that, oh, I got molested or raped. And then they tell me, oh, you sure that was what happened? You sure? Mm-hmm. You sure that that's not what you wanted? Come on, man.
Right.
That's not what I wanted. I'm not looking into to something that didn't really happen. It's happened.
Right.
So I don't like talking about it to most white people.
Yeah. And I think that's, I would say, relatively common. At least, you know, it's the friends of mine of color or in the racism workshops I've gone through. Yeah, that's. For good reason, you know, you have good reason not to trust white people with those conversations because, for the reasons, you know, that we're talking about. And for me as a pastor, and this is why we're talking about this now on the podcast, I just think, it really breaks my heart because I think, you know, in the church, Jesus calls us to love one another. Mm-hmm. And how do you love someone when you don't listen to them?
Yeah.
And how do you love someone when you don't validate their story? You know, in not validating someone's story, you're not validating like who they are. So, drives me crazy sometimes.
Yeah. So the kind of the issue is you don't have to believe everything somebody says, right?
Right.
Because as pastors, we hear people and they tell us like crazy stories that are full of lies, right? But you don't come into the conversation thinking like, oh, whatever they say is going to be automatically false, right? That's not how you come in. That's not the perspective that you come into a conversation with, right? That's not what you do. And if you come in with that perspective or whatever, the person's going to turn you off. It's guaranteed. So, yeah.
And there's a reality to it. You know, there are going to be people that use the quote-unquote race card. There's going to be people
of course.
That abuse that. And what happens is, and whatever the statistic is, I've talked to my wife about this. Like, let's say it's 5 out of 10. Like, let's say you get, and I'm just totally making that.
Yeah.
It could be 1 out of 10, could be 9 out of 10. I don't know. But what I think the standard response from white people is like, if 10 people are telling me their story, I know that at least one of them is using the race card, so I'm not going to listen to any of them.
Yeah.
And it should be the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
If just like it would be if somebody was coming to you that was molested. Like, if 10 people were telling you they were molested, sure, one or two of them or five of them might be making it up.
Yeah.
But your first thought should be, listen. Like, they are telling me the truth, and I'm going to protect them, and I'm going to take these steps to love them. And with race, majority of white people put up the defense first.
Yeah.
We don't give the benefit of the doubt, and it should be the other way around.
Well, and I kind of like, you can't all the way knock it either, because the reason why is because the perspective is so different. Like, if you grew up in your bubble, And you see all this when you're in a bubble. When somebody tells you something outside of your bubble, outside of your experience, it's like, oh, that sounds false to me.
Right.
It's because it's outside of your experience.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's, but you have to realize that, like, okay, just because this is outside of my experience doesn't mean that doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's very true. And we will talk about experience outside of experience next. I want to come back to what you were talking about with inner city schools.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting. I think about my upbringing, and I grew up in a white suburb and a, you know, good school, all that kind of stuff. And I'm trying to think of, like, as a kid, what we thought about, like, the inner city schools. You know, we played them in sports, you know, predominantly black schools.
They're loud and obnoxious. Yeah, they always want to fight.
Right.
Yeah.
But there's this thought, and the funny thing is, like, we always had, like, you know, rant, like, very small amount of black people in our school. Like, so for every, like, maybe 50 white people, there was one black person. And I think that was always an easy way for me to just never think about, like, issues of race, because, like, oh, I have one black friend out of these 50 white people, and we just treated them normal and all these things. But then you play the black school, and, like, I'm just a kid or a teen, and I didn't really understand things like urban decay and urban ghettos and how they were formed and things like that.
Yeah.
Which I want to talk about a little bit, because I think for a lot of white people, we just think, oh, this, like, inner city black school, whether it's Lansing or Detroit or, mm-hmm. like, Dayton, Ohio, which would have been my context growing up, it just, like, appeared.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, those kids need to just pull themselves up by their bootstraps, you know. And, like, those kids in that class you're talking about,
they need to work harder.
They need to quiet down.
Yeah.
They need to work harder. They just mm-hmm. need to do their homework, you know, and all this sort
of
thing.
They tell their friends to be quiet. That's right. What I'm wondering.
Right. And then you look at it now, and I live in the city. I don't know what's considered inner city, but I live in the city. Maybe it's inner city here in Lansing. And and I see, you know, we do urban ministry, you know, together here in the neighborhood, and you see, like, families, right? Mm-hmm. And there's certainly, let me first say, there's definitely good families in inner city,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Definitely.
But proportionately, I don't have any statistics in front of me, but I would say anecdotally, there is more, whether they would be dysfunctional homes or whatever you call it, single parent homes.
So some statistics, like seven out of ten, like, black families don't have fathers in the home, right?
Okay,
in the home, as far as, like, they don't live with them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, whenever you have a single parent household, you have kids that are left to themselves more often,
right?
And then, so if you have kids that are left to themselves more often, it's not good for them,
right? And there's not a parent telling them to do your homework, you know, whatever. Anecdotally, a few years ago at our park ministry, I was doing a small group with about 8 of our guys, the guys now that are, like, 16, 17. At the time, they were, like, 13.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, they were all black. I said, of the 8 of them, I said, raise your hand if your parents are married,
mm-hmm.
or ever have been. And none of them raised their hands.
Yeah.
0 out of 8.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, raise your hand if you have a relationship with your dad still.
Yeah.
And one of them, 1 out of 8, even had any type of relationship with their dad.
So 7 out of 10 of all black families. So if you go into an impoverished neighborhood, all those figures are turned up.
And that's where we find these schools, right?
Yeah.
And so my point is, can you talk a little bit about, and I should have asked you this before the interview.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with, like, redlining?
And yeah.
Can you talk about that?
I can't articulate redlining well.
Well, in your own words, and I'll jump in with some things I've just done kind of research on.
Yeah.
In your own words, how did these black and Hispanic, but these impoverished, and there's certainly white people there as well, but how did these impoverished ghettos form? They didn't just, it wasn't like everybody moved to Detroit or to Lansing or to Dayton and all the black people were like, oh, you know what, I'm going to go live in this rundown part of town.
Yeah.
And all the white people were like, I'm going to go live in this nice part of town with the nice schools and the nice roads. I mean, how did this happen?
So you don't know about redlining. There's basically, like, neighborhood charters and neighborhood laws that said that if you live in this neighborhood, you have to be white. or if you lived in this neighborhood, you can't be black.
And this was actually on the books, like, in the 60s. And, this was law. Like,
And not just that, too. It's, in the South, it might work out a little differently, where it's like, if you move here, we're going to burn a cross in your yard.
Yeah, so it's true.
Yeah, in the South, you might
talk
have
about that. What you said, there was a Hispanic family that got their car burnt, flash bombed.
That was in Florida.
And that was what year? Like, that was like...
That was like...
Not long ago.
No, that was like 9 years ago.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, but anyways, it's not a widespread practice no more, but that did happen, like, 9-10 years ago. Yeah. But anyways, so they said that, you can't live here. These are the only places you can live, right? But they're very small, like, cut-out places, so everybody had to live right on top of each other. And you add on top of that that they didn't have the jobs, they couldn't get the jobs that everybody else got, so you made them all really, really poor. So you put all of these people basically in this small circle, and then you made them really packed, which means like really overpopulated, and you made them all really poor. It's just a toxic environment. Mm-hmm. Toxic things are going to come out, and that changed. Like, I don't know when reality changed, the year it changed or whatever. But that's kind of how these neighborhoods were formed in the first place. But here's the thing: if you start out in poverty, right, and your family is in poverty, and you're in poverty, and you have that education, is really hard to get out of poverty. So, like, people's like, why don't these people just move? I would just move. Well, they don't have the money or the resources to move. They're kind of stuck. So that's why they don't move.
Yeah, and the research I did was that redlining, there was many different redlining laws about who could get loans and whatnot. They were legally off the books, the last one of them, 1970.
Okay.
Not that long ago.
Yeah.
And then another kind of historical tidbit is the GI Bill, which came in after World War II, so it would have been 1944.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with that? You want to talk about that a little bit? Or?
Yeah, I'm a little bit familiar with that. So basically, after World War II, the troops came back home, and blacks and whites were supposed to be given a GI Bill, which not only helped with education, but it helped them to buy homes. And black people were subject to the same rule, supposedly, but like 90-something% of them couldn't actually buy the homes that they wanted to buy. Not buy the homes they wanted to get. They couldn't partake of that benefit for some other reason or another.
Yeah. Exactly. And so you basically had the GI Bill given by the federal government, and it was only given more or less to white people, and that is literally how white suburbs were built.
Yeah.
And it truly is. And that's the beginning of sort of these redlining laws and those sorts of things. And if a black person moved into your neighborhood, all the home values would go down, and everybody only cares about money. Mm-hmm. And so they made these rules to keep the black people out.
Yeah,
and it just wasn't that long ago. I think it's important. The reason I bring it up is because it plays into Baltimore, you know, it plays into these things like
all those, especially like East Coast cities, and even like here in Michigan and stuff. All the North, really, that's huge. In the South is a little bit different.
But and from what I understand, I read this in Divided by Faith by Michael Emerson and Christian Smith about redlining. Was the reason it started happening was during that period of time. I think it was during the war. There were, I could be wrong on the during the war part, but during that period of time, there were cheap labor jobs available in the cities for the first time ever. And so you had blacks that were migrating north to the northern cities to take these jobs.
The Great Exodus, people call it.
Okay,
there was a couple ways to get the Great Exodus.
And so they...
So I would encourage people to do, like, research on all this stuff, because all this stuff is coming off, like, from research probably, like, a year or two ago for me. I don't know how far ago, long ago for you. So you should read this stuff, and maybe Noah could post them.
I'll post it on the blog, and I always encourage people, particularly white people, to read Divided by Faith by Michael Emerson and Christian Smith. Great book for white Christians to read. But it was like the black people were moving from the South to the North for these industrial jobs, and the white people used to live in the urban core.
Yeah,
and then it was like, shoot, we don't want to live by these black people, and that's why we call it white flight. And that's when it began.
And then a lot of those jobs, they end up disappearing with when the immigrants came around, with so Irish immigrants or Italian immigrants, they end up moving in. I'm not knocking that or whatever, but they moved in, and then like people will be more likely to hire the white Irish guy or the white Italian guy, so a lot of these black jobs disappeared. So it grew unemployment, and I'm not excusing the crime rate rise, but the crime rate rose with that same phenomenon.
Yeah, and I think it's just important. It's not like we bring this up to say, and now we're going to give you the like 5-minute solution to all these things. But when you see Baltimore in the news or whatever it might be, or you see the relationship between police and Eric Garner, you know, I think it's very important to understand the history behind these things so that we can understand the gravity and the complexity of them. They are very, very, very complex.
Yeah, it's complex issues.
Without understanding the complexity, your thoughts are going to be racist. I mean, they're going to be. They're going to be wrong. And I think it's just we've got to be educated better on this stuff.
Yeah.
So I believe that a lot of these blow-ups, so the recent memory, I think it started with Ferguson as far as like news stories that just hit the news everywhere. Like the story, lots of energy, lots of action around a certain story. And there's been several kind of in between, and then Baltimore is the most recent one. As I observe our society, I think that what's led to these things is how segregated our society still is.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, so a lot of times people want to know, well, what can we do to solve these things? And when they happen, I don't know, but I know that before they happen, what we could do is be less segregated. Now, I'm a pastor. This is a ministry podcast. I'm really called and really believe that part of the problem that's perpetuated this is how segregated the church has been.
Mm-hmm.
The church is crazy segregated.
Yes. Well, segregated time in the week is Sunday morning.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And I don't have the stat in front of me, but in Divided by Faith, when they did their sociological kind of overview, mm-hmm. I believe it was in 1998, like only 2.5% of Christian churches were multiracial.
And that's like 20%, right?
20% it's that your majority group is 80%,
yeah,
and then the other 20 it would be non-majority group.
Yeah.
So really, that's not even that multi-ethnic.
No, not at all.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
If you have 100 people and 80 of them are white, it's still feeling pretty white.
Yeah.
But or
vice versa.
The more and the more recent study. Emerson just spoke at the Kainos conference in Memphis I went to, and it was good news. It had gone up to, I think, 7% the more recent survey they did. Still a long way to go. But
yeah.
And don't quote me on those stats.
Yeah.
Look up Michael Emerson for the exact, but it's ballpark. So, David, what I want to talk about, well, first of all, there's a lot of mistrust and stereotyping that happens when we're very separate, right?
Yeah.
Very segregated. Talk about your experience in Watts and Compton. When I remember you talked to teens, and I think you said you had a similar experience as a child or as a youth, where like these teens were saying they literally, and describe Watts and Compton if people aren't familiar with those neighborhoods. I think some are, they're pretty notorious.
Yeah.
But they never saw a white person in their neighborhood, like ever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then so what was their perspective of white people as a result?
So All right, so Watts is that's the place I was mostly in. I was in Compton quite a bit too, but I was mostly in Watts. So Watts is notorious for gangs. So it's not like I don't know what your how much you guys know on gangs already. So I'm trying, it's kind of hard to explain. So it's like the gangs are out there like almost like armies, where it's not like 20 people or 40 people or 100 people. You can have like 2,000 or 3,000 people in one gang. And all these gangs are carved out into different territories. So literally, if you cross the line to another territory, from one gang to another gang, a lot of times you will get something called banged on. So that means somebody will say like, oh, what gang are you from? And if you're from the wrong gang, they will attack you at that point in time. So it's a very like dangerous place. It's gotten better over the last couple years, but it's still a very dangerous place. Gangs are still a huge part of those areas. But he's right. Like, everybody in Watts and Compton, not Compton particularly, but Watts, everybody in Watts, almost everybody, is either black or Hispanic. And the only white people there are either, like, teachers or police, really. Teachers or police. I saw, like, all the times I've been to Watts, I saw one white person that lived there. And I was shocked. I was literally shocked. I remember this one time, too. I was living in Philadelphia. It's the same type of deal. It's like 23rd and Reed Street in Philadelphia, if you're familiar with it. It's getting more more Caucasians are getting there now. But I remember one time I was sitting on my porch and I saw a white man running, jogging by, and I was shocked too. I was like, he probably took a wrong turn. So it's like, it's really segregated society. So I'll sit down with like a gang intervention group, and I'll have like, it could be anywhere from like 30 kids to like, it could be 8 to 10 kids or whatever. And I remember one time I was sitting around with 8 to 10 kids, and like, we start talking about white people, and like, they started coming up with these crazy, crazy stereotypes, like these off-the-wall stereotypes of white people. And I was like, oh, that's not true. That's not true. That never happened. And they started saying all these things that white people did. And I was like, oh, that's white people. All white people don't do that. They really don't. Like, white people don't tongue kiss their dogs? No, not all white people. Or whatever. So, like, you get stuff like that. And then other stuff, too, like darker stuff, too. And then they'll talk about white people as like, oh, they're out to get us. They're out to get us. They're out to get us. And then I don't know, I said it or somebody else said it. I can't remember who said it. No, it wasn't me who said it. It was somebody else who said it. I know for sure it was somebody else who said it. It was one of the kids. And some one of the kids was like, no, they're not out to get us. They just don't care about us. Mm-hmm. And I was like, mm-hmm. And that's kind of like, that was kind of true, because they were all in this impoverished, terrible area. And for the most part, the people who care about them aren't from people from outside of those neighborhoods, or aren't people who have experienced those neighborhoods. People in Orange County and the suburbs, not all of them, of course. I'm sure there's some great Orange County people who do great works in the inner city. But there are some for sure now, because like there's been some Calvary Chapel movements who go into the inner city now. It's been doing some beautiful things. But for the most part, it's true. They don't care about you. So, yeah.
Did you have an experience like that growing up, where you just were pretty isolated from white people?
Yeah, so when I lived in Greenwood, Mississippi. Greenwood, Mississippi is a town that is high majority black. And for a while, I was going to an all black school. For the most part, we had two white kids in our whole school, and they were like second and fourth grade. I never saw them. But anyways, it was St. Francis Catholic School or whatever. Anyways. So, and even there, I would hear all types of rumors of about white people. And I would see white people like here and there through different things. And like, especially as I got older, I started going to like white schools and stuff like that. But it's still segregated. Like, I would go to a white school, and even when I went to a white school, I always sat at the black table, right? Or if I didn't sit at the black table, I sat at the Hispanic table. And then if I had white friends, but not really friends, I'll say I had white associates. Cause they'll be like high and by. You'd be like, hey, how you doing? How's it going? But we never like share lives. So I had all these perspectives on white people growing up that I didn't know it was true or it was false. And then when I got into the Coast Guard, because I was in the Coast Guard for like 5 years, and I started actually spending a lot of time with white people, I started learning all types of stuff about white people that I didn't even know.
Mm. Yeah. That's good, man. I think a lot of the white narrative is that this is not a church issue. Like, mm-hmm. when we bring this up in church, whether it's in a sermon or we do a workshop on it or whatever, like, let's not talk about this stuff in church, because this isn't like a biblical issue, or this isn't a church issue, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Whereas obviously I disagree with that, and I think the church is a big reason, and it's something divided by faith brings out a lot. The white church particularly has just perpetuated racism and all these issues we're talking about, because we don't bring them up, and so we just remain separate. It seems like race issues are talked about more in the black church. Mm-hmm.
More so on not race issues as facts of like, let's come together as a church community,
right,
and become one. That's not how race issues are talked about. Race issues are talked about like, how do we solve the race issues that are going on with black people,
right?
Which is not good neither. I'm not knocking it, because we should do that. We should like try to help our brothers out, especially with race issues that are going on. But that's not the end all be all. We should want to be one whole body instead of two separate things that going on. And that so like I was reading like a comment from John Perkins. I was reading, mm-hmm. on your blog, I think it was, and I thought the statement, I don't remember the exact statement. I'm about to butcher it. But he basically said to a bunch of black pastors, he's like, I know that the church is the only thing that white people ever gave us, right? To be our own, only thing of prominence that white people ever gave us, but we have to give that up to become one. Mm-hmm. And I paraphrase, and mm-hmm. you can find that on Noah's blog, mm-hmm. or whatever. And I think that's true, though. I think that's really true. In like the '90s, we went I'm in Mississippi, in that same town of Mississippi, because it had black and white churches or whatever. I don't know. It might have been a little bit outside of our town or whatever, because we had a high majority black town that we were in. But we were going to this white church for a little while. And we were going there. And my dad became really good friends with the pastor. The pastor was big on racial equality and stuff like that. And anyways, so we were going there for a while, and some people were kind of mean, or some people gave us the cold shoulder. Some people were warm to us. But there was another lady who came into the church who was actually from the town, and they came to her by herself. And it's like, them black folks know better. Get your N-word, basically, out of here and don't come back or whatever. Those black folks don't know better, because my dad was in the Air Force and we just moved into town or whatever.
Wow.
You're from here. You should know better. Get out of here. And this is the 90s, right?
Wow.
And then after that, my dad talked to the pastor, and they ended up leaving. They were still really good friends or whatever. So that was in the 90s, right? So it's like, for a long, long time, black and white churches, like black people, not only the black people didn't want to go to white churches, it's almost like they couldn't go. And I remember I've been to white churches too, like in 2006, 2007, 2009, 2010, where I go into a white church and I try to shake people's hands and nobody will shake my hand. Mm. Like, so it's like, yeah, so it's like, it's, I don't know. That was a long rant.
No, that's good, man.
But the basis of the rant is like, there's such as the segregation in the church is, It's sinful. It really is. It's sinful. It's sinful. And not on one side neither. It's on both sides, because we're supposed to be all one body. We're all supposed to love each other as brothers. And if we're divided by color, then I don't know. It's crazy. It's crazy.
That John Perkins blog post was about a workshop, or not a workshop, a luncheon, like a pastor luncheon I was at. And it was about like 20 black pastors or so and 20 white pastors or so. And he said that statement you said, which I thought was like, I need some slang here to help me out with. It was real, man.
Yeah.
It was like, wow, he just said that, you know?
Yeah.
But these are like black pastors. He's like, and then to the white pastors, actually, he said to them, he goes, look, and this was sort of, I thought, very real and very true to the white church. He said, he's like, look, this needs to happen. Like, it's biblical for the church to be multiracial, like, mm-hmm. to not be segregated, all these sorts of things. The white church isn't going to do it. Mm-hmm. He said they're too imperialistic, mm-hmm. and they have all the resources. So like, why? And he's saying this to, you know, half of us there are white, pastors,
mm-hmm.
and he's right, you know, and there's a reason that, you know, we haven't taken the steps to like make this happen, even though this is a biblical issue.
Yeah. So here, I remember my point to that whole Lone May story. Anyway, so my point to that story was like, integration is a significant issue, even on the black side, right?
Yeah.
On the black side, it's a significant issue, right? But it there should be steps to like to break those walls down,
right?
Because and that's what they're giving up. They're giving up like some like. Like, because in the black church, it was almost like, okay, especially like in the 60s and the 70s and the 50s and the 40s, it's like, okay, this is home. We can say whatever we want to say.
Exactly.
We can be whoever we want to be. It's this, like, I don't know. It's just, and they found identity in that almost.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, it's something significant that the black pastors don't want to give up. Some black pastors don't want to give up.
Right.
Some are willing to.
And I think it's important as we learn this history that, for me and my perspective as a white pastor, is that the white church started it.
Mm-hmm.
We caused it. And so I understand the black perspective
from
the 60s and how even that's carried over to today. What I really don't understand or really can't really give any benefit of the doubt to is how the white church doesn't really see that we started this. Like, we didn't let black people in to our churches.
Mm-hmm.
And we do it in more indirect ways now.
Yeah.
But we still don't make our churches hospitable to black people. So that's...
I think a lot of white pastors, I think they have a desire to some level to be a multiracial church,
right?
And they do want black people to come into their churches, and it's not like it's a, oh, I don't want you to be here anymore. I think it's just like a lack of knowledge. That's what I think it is. It's just like they don't know.
Right.
They don't know the issues. They just don't know.
Yeah. Well, and I totally agree with that. You're not going to find nobody verbally, not very many that would say, I don't want black people in my church. I mean, most would say the opposite.
Yeah.
But there's different words used, but some want a multicolored church, but not a multi, you know, not actually like a multicultural church.
Yeah.
So, or we just talk about surface level things and never get to the deeper issues. Like, we're not going to talk about white privilege. We're not going to talk about
systemic issues
like we've been talking about in this podcast, because if you talk about those things, you're going to offend the white Christians and they're going to leave your church. And it's like, well, would Jesus have talked about these things?
Yeah, yeah.
He would have. Like, mm-hmm. right, he did on the Jew-Gentile divide. He mm-hmm. would have done it on the black-white divide mm-hmm. as well. Was Jesus afraid of people leaving him because he spoke the truth? No, he did that all the time. So mm-hmm. it needs to be, to be talked about.
Yeah.
I mean, it just does. Cause, and let me read kind of as a transition. I want to read Ephesians 2, mm-hmm. 14 through 16. If you didn't know these verses were in the Bible, there's several passages I really like when it comes to multi-ethnic church, but this is probably the best. And it comes after Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, that a lot of people know, that it's by grace we've been saved through faith. Well, saved for what? Verse 10 tells us to do these good works. Well, what good works? Keep reading. Verse 14 says, "For he," speaking of Jesus, "for he himself is our peace, who's made the two," speaking of Jews and Gentiles, "one, and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by abolishing in his flesh the law with its commandments and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new man out of the two, thus making peace, and in this one body to reconcile both of them to God through the cross, by which he put to death their hostility." Mm-hmm. And I just don't think there's any coincidence that Jews and Gentiles were two different ethnic groups mm-hmm. that couldn't get along. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to be in church together.
No.
And the power of the cross broke down that hostility and was to bring them together.
Yeah. So, like, here's like a white response that you might hear to that, right? It is like, oh, we are all one now. So there is no black or white no more. So this isn't an issue anymore. We should all be one, right? We should all just be one. They should all just come to our churches and be one.
All be white.
Yeah. And that's the issue. It's like, the issue is, like, unless you do church the way that we do church,
right,
then you're not doing church right. This is how you should do it.
Exactly.
When your church started from a Western perspective. Yeah, anyways. Yeah.
Western European and even oppressive white supremacy.
Yeah, when you have people like, people are quoting the pure, I'm not knocking the Puritans. So
I hear you, man.
I'm not knocking the Puritans. I'm not knocking like Jonathan Edwards and stuff like that. But you own slaves. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And that's the church that you want to appeal to is like, oh, this is the right way to do things.
Yes.
And so when somebody comes in like, no, that's not the right way to do things, it's like, oh, we're all one. We should just all be one. Can't we just be Christians together? Shouldn't you just, what they want is basically like assimilation. I want you to assimilate black people.
Assimilate to becoming Western and white.
Western Christians.
And that's, you hear people say, we need to be colorblind or I don't see color. And to not see color is to not see someone's story. It's to not see someone's individualism. It's to not see what they've gone through.
Yeah.
And it's to tell them, you have to be like me. You have to act like me. You have to talk like me. You have to look like me. And that is not what Jesus is saying here.
Yeah.
Exactly. At all.
That's so true. Yeah. And like even Paul's like, I'll be all things to all men, out to reach as many. Like mm-hmm. in 1 Corinthians 9, 2 Corinthians 9.
Yeah.
Anyways, so here's the other thing too. Black and white people were not different as far as genetically, right? Race is so arbitrary, right? Race is super arbitrary. Like, I look, like, if you looked at me, I could be like a Brazilian, I could be a Dominican, I could mm-hmm. be anything. But America made this whole racial structure mm-hmm. that makes me black instead of something else or whatever. So, like, we're not saying that, like, black and white people are different. That's not what we're saying at all. What we're saying is we come from two different cultural perspectives.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's not all black people. There's some black people who grew up, I don't know, surrounded by Caucasians, and their cultural perspective is exactly like yours. And that might be some of your friends, like some of your friends that you were talking about that they grew up with you or whatever. That might be some of your friends. So that might be why he has the same perspective as you. A lot of what we're talking about is, like, impoverished, or not necessarily impoverished, but like, I don't know.
But there is, this might help, there is a culture of that black people have had to their culture has been formed by the oppression that they've had to endure.
Yeah.
Right. And mm-hmm. so that has formed
its own culture. Yeah.
What has become Black culture mm-hmm. in many ways.
Yeah.
And so while you might have a Black person that was, you know, didn't grow up with that as their culture, a white cop is still going to see them.
Oh yeah,
and
they'll be shocked.
And a white, right? But a white cop will take all that Black culture stereotype that the white cop has, mm-hmm. like the negative aspect, yeah. and they're going to put it on that person yeah. because of their skin color.
Yeah, like one time I was driving through the suburbs or whatever. I was going to a Bible study, and I got pulled over, and it was two white cops, and they're like, "Where are you going?" And I'm like, "I'm going to Bible study." He was like, "Effing Bible study." I was like, "Yeah, Bible study. Why are you so nervous?" I was thinking, because you're cursing at me, you're kind of yelling at me.
Right.
And then I was like, he's like, "What's that under your seat?" And I was like, "I don't have anything under my seat." And I started reaching to like show him what's under my seat. There's nothing under my seat. And then like they ripped me out of the car. They throw me against the car or whatever. They ripped my car apart, right? They find the Bible or whatever, and they look inside the Bible like there's going to be, like, drugs in there or something. And so, like, yeah. So I was really there for Bible study, but I was in a white neighborhood. I was a Black guy riding around in not the best car because I was kind of impoverished at that point. And so they thought, like, oh, criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you're right. You're right. That's true. Like, they still carry all those same negative stereotypes. To every stop. Not all cops, though. Like, I know good police.
Sure,
my
sure.
brother-in-law is a police officer. He's a great guy. I love my brother-in-law. But it's some police.
Right.
And here's the thing, too. Like, speaking of, like, stereotypes, too. It's like, because of those bad police, right? Because of the police, those bad guys.
Yes.
We, in turn, whenever I see a cop pull somebody over, sometimes I think, like, man, they just messing with that person
right.
for no reason. Well, they could be, like, messing with them for a legitimate reason. And it all fuels into each other.
That's a great point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does fuel. And in the inner city, especially with some of these young kids that are 14, 15,
yeah.
man, it's way more exacerbated even than that, right? When they yeah. see police, it's like, they're
oh,
the enemy.
You they know, are right? the enemy.
And they locked up this person.
Yeah, you gotta look at it from their perspective, too. Like, people are like, Why do they act like that when police? Why is he talking back to police? All the type of stuff like that. You gotta look at it as from like a 2 or 3 year old. Look, only white people that they ever see is the ones who are knocking in their door,
right.
ripping out their loved ones, and they never see them again.
Right,
because
right.
it's the police, right?
Yeah.
Or
Child Protective Services.
Or Child Protective yeah. Services. Which is less common. It's a lot more common up here, but
okay.
it's less common
yeah.
in other places. Anyways, are like. You're walking down the street and you see a police officer pull up and they're yelling somebody or putting somebody in handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
So only perspective that you have on white people is very limited, and it's like, oh, they are the enemy. They attack us,
mm-hmm.
they take us, and they throw us in jail. They're evil, and that's how they see the police, and that's why they respond like they do.
Let's transition a little bit here.
Yeah.
As we kind of move a little bit towards a close,
yeah.
talk about doing urban ministry versus the standard mindset of youth ministry. And I'll kind of throw in a little side here. You know, when we talk about youth ministry, usually what we're talking about is suburban white youth ministry, but
yeah.
we never say that.
Yeah.
And if you, I went to like an undergrad, I studied youth ministry. That was my major. Like
yeah.
that was my degree. And
mm-hmm.
I was a youth pastor for a year and a half. And really what I was taught was suburban white youth ministry.
Yeah.
You know, and I've given you resources before, like, "Hey, David, I got this book for free. Check it out." And you're like, "Oh, this is a good material, but this is for like white suburban youth. This won't work." It doesn't say that on the cover.
Yeah.
No, imagine if it did.
Yeah. It should.
But talk about that a little bit. Like, what are the differences of doing youth ministry in an urban setting? And why are there materials out there even?
No.
Okay, right.
So you gotta look at it like this, right?
Oh, and say this as you talk about it. Give advice to like some people listening that are like, "I want to help with urban youth ministry. Like, I'm white, yeah, and I live in the suburbs, but I want to help."
Yeah.
But, like, their framework, they don't know the framework of how to help. So talk about that as well.
All right, cool. So two questions. All right. So like, as far as like just to delineate his point more, like if you go on the internet and you look for youth pastor jobs, right? If you go on
sure.
the internet, this is the only job I applied to for a youth pastor job. That's the only youth pastor job I'm proud to, because they particularly put on their outline or whatever, or their job description, they're looking for urban youth pastor to reach inner city teens. And that's the only one I applied to. I've seen probably hundreds, maybe thousands of job postings, right? And they might have in there that they must be willing to reach out to all cultures and reach the unchurched. But there's never like, we're going to reach the inner city. Like, almost never for all of those youth pastor jobs. So they got like almost all youth pastor jobs are for like suburban. Yeah.
Can I give a shameless plug?
Go ahead, shameless plug.
And that's because there's no money in the inner city. Okay. Yeah,
that's true.
And so those churches, inner city, this is the problem with segregated churches as well. So the only churches with money to hire youth pastors are white suburban churches.
Yeah.
Shameless plug, your position is support race.
Yeah.
That's why we can afford it.
Yeah.
Because we're basically a poor urban church.
Yeah.
So if you want to support David's salary, you can. Honestly, you can do that.
All right, cool.
You could send us on PayPal to info@lansingcrossroads.com. But we... Kurt and I, our other white pastor, we raised outside support to actually make this position because there was no way our church could afford it.
Yeah.
So there's my shameless plug.
And here's the thing, too. There's not a lot of money in inner city ministry, right?
Right.
So, like, let's say I got all of my teens together. Not all of mine, but, like, most of my teens together. Most of my teens are impoverished. This is true. They're impoverished. Most of them come from single parent households. They don't have barely but any money. So they're not going to bring any money into the church, right? And even if their parents came, it's not like their parents could bring a whole lot of money to the church either. Like if they gave you 10%, it'd be 10% of like, I don't know, $16,000 a year or $20,000 a year, mm-hmm. which is just not that much, especially not as much as it costs. So there's not like a lot of money into it. I'm not saying that stops people from doing it, but I don't think that it helps.
Mm-hmm.
So anyways, the difference between urban youth ministry and suburban youth ministry, the difference is, I don't think to the core there are huge differences except like on a programming level. Like some of the things that you do at like a white youth ministry, or not like just white youth ministry, but suburban youth ministry, it just won't fly in the inner city. That'll be lame to them. But so anyways, let's get away from that though. Mm-hmm. Let's get away from the differences as far as if you show up, right? If you show up and you show up with an open mind and you love on kids, right? And you share with them Jesus in an honest way. You show up with an open mind, you love on kids, and you share with them Jesus in an honest way. At first, they probably won't like you. That's true. At first, they probably won't like you. But the more you show up and the more consistent you are, they will like you, mm-hmm. and they will want to listen to you. And that's it. That's the simple. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of these kids are like love starved. So if you like love them, they're willing to listen. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's the whole picture. Yeah.
Why is consistency so important?
So you got to look at it like this. Like, not all of them. Like that's the problem with like conversations like these, because like you could get like you could think like, okay, you could have
right.
having new stereotypes.
You're
your
right.
Mind.
You're right.
But there's a significant portion of them who like they have people coming in and out of their life all the mm-hmm. time. Mom got a new boyfriend. Dad got locked up again. You know what I'm saying? So like it's. Or like, oh, I'm at home alone for like 2 weeks because my parents just went on a drug binge or something, right? So you have all these people who are inconsistent. And if you show up and you're inconsistent too, you're just like everybody else. Mm-hmm. You're just another person who left out on them. So that's why you got to be consistent. That's why you can't show up and be like, oh, I'll try it out for a week or two. And then you leave because you leave them more broken than they were before.
Mm-hmm. And I bring that up too because I think that's been sort of the MO of a lot of white suburban churches.
It's yeah, like, we'll do an outreach.
We'll go to the park, the park that's in the ghetto, and we'll do like a carnival for the mm-hmm. day, and we'll give out a bunch of free toys.
Take
and
some nice pictures.
Some pictures yeah. and those sorts of things.
Hugging little black babies.
And there's a lot we could talk about there, yeah. but
That's not always though, and I'm sure like a lot of those, like if you've been a part of ministry like that, I'm sure that the heart behind that was really good, right? It was a really good heart that you wanted to love on people, but that's not an effective way
right.
to disciple.
Be consistent with it.
Yeah.
Do something like that, and then use it to launch something that's consistent.
Yeah.
Like be there and be consistent, be incarnational. I
yeah.
mean that's what Jesus did.
Yeah.
You know, that's so yeah.
Yeah.
So as we wind this down, a lot of times when we talk about race. I can speak for a lot of like white friends of mine or white people that I know. A lot of times it's just defense mechanisms. Now, if those people have probably turned off this interview by now,
yeah.
they'd be like, oh, them, I'm just creating a race issue. They're, you know, they're
yeah.
all this stuff, whatever. But my point is,
I almost hate that I did this interview.
I already got you.
Yeah, I got you.
But I say that a little bit tongue in cheek, you know, about people that have turned off the interview. But my point is, just give some advice for people. I really do think this is a spiritual maturity thing. I think this is part of our discipleship. And we always shut down when this stuff comes up, and we have like knee-jerk reactions, defense mechanisms. So give some wisdom as we near a close here on how we, a person listening, can grow spiritually and just be humble and say, I want to mature in this, you know, without those feelings of like, you're accusing me of this, or these defense mechanisms that end up like shutting this conversation from even happening.
Yeah. So I don't know. Let me think for a second. So whenever you get confronted on a sin that you do, right, it's going to feel bad. It's going to make you feel crunchy. And I got plenty of them. I'm not saying that I'm better because I'm black or whatever. And there are specific sins for the black community as well that's different than the white community or whatever. But the idea of feeling crunchy, what crunchy basically means, like guilty and feeling bad, is that you would do something to change, right? You would turn away from that sin. You would take steps to turn away from that sin or whatever. Or maybe it's not sin, because it could not be sin. It could be something that you didn't even like know.
It could be. That's a good point. It's something new that you're learning.
Yeah,
you just don't know what you don't know, but now you're being shown it and you're learning it. So
exactly. So it might not be sin or whatever. It might just be like, okay, this is brand new to me. But whenever you get exposed to something like that, it should sting a little bit. That's a good thing, mm-hmm. right? But that stinging should turn to action. If this stinging just turns to, oh, I beat myself up and I sit inside and I'm sad about it for a week or two, and then I go back to living the same old that I used to live, then it's not really that valuable. So like, basically, let it sting, but let it cause you to turn to action. Because a lot of times the pushback, and I've got a pushback too, right? I've been called out on stuff before. Like, I've been called out specifically on being like prideful before, right? And my knee-jerk reaction is like defensiveness. But right. The only reason why I get that knee-jerk reaction for defensiveness is because it's true, right? If somebody accuses me of something that I know I don't do, I'm like, I don't do that, and I keep going. But I get defensive because it's true. So let it sting and cause you to repent or whatever. And here's, I want to say this, like, closing too. Like, race is not the end-all be-all, right? It's not the end-all be-all. Like, let's say we got racial problems completely solved in America. It's not gonna save people's souls.
Right.
So it's not the end-all be-all. But it's just like any other thing that's a sin, right? It's any other thing that's a darkness in our culture. We should work, especially within the church, to change those things. It's not like we know, like, lying is not the end-all be-all neither. But if we're exposed that lying is wrong, we take steps to change it, not because it's an all be all, but because it makes us stronger as a church. Does that make sense? Or doesn't
yes.
make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Let me say this, because some people will say, and I've been accused of this, you're replacing the gospel with like race,
racism.
And
no.
you make a great point, because nobody would ever say that about, like, if I did a sermon on lying
or pride,
nobody's gonna say, oh, you're replacing the gospel with pride. Like pride or like or humility. You know, you're talking about humility too much. We only say that about race.
Yeah.
And I would encourage people to just see this along, treat it the way you would treat other sins, which I think is what you're saying.
Yeah.
And it's not a replacement of the gospel. I really believe it's an extension of it. It's one of the teachings of Jesus. It's a product of it.
So the gospel doesn't stop with us going to heaven.
Right. Exactly.
The gospel is like, he makes all things new. We become new creatures or whatever.
Yes.
So since we become new creatures, all things should change. So it's not limiting the gospel. What happens is, when you say that the gospel is people going to heaven, you're limiting the gospel.
Right.
The gospel was never that. It was never meant to be that. Read the scriptures. It's not that at all. The gospel makes all things new, so all things should change. And there's things that I'm changing. There's like a lot of things that I'm changing too. Like things that I grew up where my perspective was completely wrong on everything, that I have to change. And that's how I grew up. But that doesn't make it right.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to close out here. I'm going to, David is also a spoken word artist, and he has a poem. Give me the name of it again.
Dad Was Locked Up.
Dad Was Locked Up, and I will put a link to this poem on, David's going to perform it live here, but I'll put a link to it on the blog post as well. And I'll just end the interview with this, and we'll close out the episode with this poem. So with that, I'll kind of give my parting words here. Encourage you to check out acrossroads.net for these extra resources we've been talking about. This issue of race is a complex one. I encourage you to forget. Please forgive us. Honestly, you know, if we've stepped out of bounds at all, this is a hard thing to talk about, but it's needed. Perfect. It's needed to talk about, and we need to be able to talk about it with humility and grace, and not fear like we have to do it perfectly, because then we'll never do it. But I do have, if you go to the topics section of atacrossroads.net, there's dozens of articles now that I've written on race. I'd encourage you to check those out. So, David, I don't know if you have any concluding words. Go ahead and give them to us, and then when you're ready, go ahead and give us your poem.
Yeah. So concluding words is, I'm not perfect. I'm not saying that the black community is perfect. I'm not saying that the white community is terrible. I love you. If I hurt your feelings, I'm sorry. I did not mean to. That was not my intentions at all. I feel really uncomfortable that we just did this interview. But anyways, so I love you people. I love all of y'all. All right. So this is how this the poem is basically. Anyways, I'll just do the poem. Ready? All right. Dad was locked up. Ma was strung out. She always had that glass pipe in her freaking mouth. Back when I was little, I could barely see. But I could see she loved that glass pipe more than me. Mama, mama, I'm hungry. It's been 3 days since I had something in my tummy. Why'd you sell the food stamps? We ain't need the money, but she higher than Aladdin, so she think that crap is funny. And I'm feeling like a dummy for waiting by the door. For praying she coming back. For crying on the floor. But she ain't coming back, man. I already know. It still took me 2 weeks before I walked outside the door. And now I'm at my auntie house. She got 6 kids. The kids got 3 kids with me. That makes 10. We fighting over crumbs like a couple of base heads. And auntie ain't home because she chasing that paycheck. And what's worse, ain't nobody noticed me. When I walk inside a room, no one knows it's me. I'm just a dirty, hungry kid they can't stand to see. Hey, can I get a bite? Get away from me, huh? Yeah, man, it was just me. House full of people, but dag, it was just me. Hoping for somebody to come and try to love me, but ain't nobody coming, dog, and ain't nobody loving D. But my big homies noticed me. When I started game banging, my big homies, they noticed me. My big homies, they bought me food. My big homies, they let me cruise. When I was running around barefoot, my big homies, they bought me shoes. So what I'm supposed to do? When he hands me the tool, and he says, I gotta do what I gotta do. Yo, what I'm supposed to do? When he hands me the tool. And he says, I gotta do what I gotta do. Rob him, rob him. Yeah, I'm gonna rob him. Drop him, drop him. Yeah, I'm gonna drop him. Do whatever I got to. Bruh, it ain't a problem, cause money flying everywhere and quitting ain't an option. I'm a goblin with a broken heart and a shattered dream. Screwed up from the start. Yo, my chance to fail, it was off the charts. I ain't picked the lines, I just played my part. Oh, that's not true. Cause yeah, man, I always picked. There's always a choice, no matter how hard it is. Let's skip past the tears and get to the heart of it. I've been up on 108th, aka Banana Clip, shooting at some kids that grew up just like I did. Robbing to the end, they screwed up just like I is. Looking to their eyes, they my eyes, and I knew this, but I ain't even care. Definition of ruthless, definition of Judas you is. Cause I'm betraying myself with everything that I do. It's crazy how I can slang crack to a lady that reminds me of my mama while she holding a baby. And maybe, man, it's not my problem. And I won't ever care. I'ma keep on robbing. I'ma keep on trapping. I'ma keep on mopping. But if I think God's gonna pity me, I need to stop it. Cause I ain't pity them. Yeah, I was a Vic. But I also love the sin, man. I also love the sex, man. I also love the gin. Hand me another bottle. I just blame it on the fam. But God, I know you know. And you know I know. That this ain't right, man. And this ain't life, yo. God wants to take me out the dark and the light. Show me more to this nightmare that I call life, bro. I know. But I'm a bad man, stab man, hate speech, lying every moment, fam. Dang, I freaking hate me. Violence in my veins, everybody thinks I'm crazy. But in spite of all that, Jesus, will you save me?
1, 2, 3, 4. Well, I went down to the crossroads down.